I am Jeremy Dean QC. I have been practicing as a criminal defense barrister since 1983. This series of podcasts spotlights the criminal justice process, a cornerstone of our free and democratic society. I will also be looking at the effects of coronavirus upon the criminal justice system. I will be speaking to prisoners, prisoners' relatives, campaigners, lawyers, and others. Together, we will take a global look at the criminal justice process under the scourge of coronavirus and generally. This is Criminal Justice on Trial. Welcome to a further episode of Criminal Justice on Trial. I am absolutely delighted to welcome as my guest today Penelope Gibbs, who is director of the charity Transform Justice. Penelope, thank you so much for giving up your time to speak to me.
It's a pleasure.
Transform Justice is a national charity working for a fair, humane, open and effective justice system. I think that's a fair summary. Do you agree?
It is, but it's a massive task to do with such a small charity. We do our best. I think the important thing to realise is we're really, really small. And so we do what we can being small. I think I see it as almost a criminal justice think tank.
Right.
So what we're doing is shining a light on how the system, the criminal justice system works, but we're particularly interested in whether it's fair for defendants and suspects.
Right. Well, that's a very clear introduction, and as a criminal defence practitioner, if I may say so, an incredibly laudable set of objectives. In terms of your personal background, I mean, you I think, worked for the Prison Reform Trust for a period of about 5 years.
Yeah, I mean, my interest in justice goes back to being a radio producer myself. So I worked for many years as a producer on Woman's Hour, and I did a lot of stories about justice. And at that point, I thought, you should try and make a difference. So I applied to become a magistrate, and I sat at Highbury Corner Magistrates Courts for about 3 years. And then a job came up at the Prison Reform Trust, which I just thought was very exciting, which was about trying to reduce the number of children, that is under 18-year-olds and young people in prison in the UK. And it was a well-funded project. And also I liked the fact that it had a very clear goal, this reduction in numbers, but it didn't say exactly how that might be achieved. So Prison Reform Trust, fantastic penal reform charity, and I worked on that programme for the full 5 years. And in that 5 years, the number of under 18-year-olds in prison in England and Wales went down by a third. So when I started, there were around 3,000 under 18-year-olds in prison. And when I finished, there were around 2,000, and they're now less than 1,000.
I mean, why do you think that the starting point was so much higher than the end point? And how did the need to decrease that figure of child detainees reflect upon the criminal justice process?
I mean, it was a very, very complex process. And unfortunately, under the height of New Labour, there were drives to reduce street robbery, and there was something called offences brought to justice, where the police had targets, just straight numbers targets, for the number of people, including children, who they got through the system, either using cautions, out of court disposals, or convictions. And that ramped up the numbers of teenagers who were prosecuted and charged, and later on just pushed them right through the system. And hence the numbers got to where they were. You had really a lot of teenagers who had done non-violent offences, in prison. And then getting back from that point, partly it was that the government thankfully abandoned the offences brought to justice target. So the police were no longer kind of arresting a lot of teenagers in the same way. And I just think there was a realisation also, partly promoted by us at the Prison Reform Trust, that imprisoning a teenager is utterly counterproductive and negative.
Right. I mean, we could spend the whole of this podcast discussing that fascinating aspect, but you've encapsulated the issues there starkly. I want just to pick you up on one other aspect of what you've been telling us so far, because I note that one of the reports that features on your website is magistrates, representatives of the people, and you yourself have been a magistrate, and I have appeared before many magistrates, and I have my own views on the extent to which magistrates might be regarded as representatives of the people, but you have personal experience. So the question I want to ask you is, are magistrates representatives of the people?
No. I mean, it's not just my personal experience. What I try very hard to do at Transform Justice is always to gather evidence. It has to be said that in the sense of being representative of different classes and different ages, magistrates have never been representative of the people. They've always been skewed upper middle class and older. Gender divide is pretty much okay and has been for a while, though obviously historically there were more men. So it's never been representative of the people. What's interesting about them, and I saw that when I was a magistrate myself, I started in my 40s and was perceived to be young. And most magistrates are over 60. You have to retire at 70. Mm. It's partly because it's a sort of closed world where people outside certain social groups don't even know that it's possible to apply to be a magistrate. There's a lot of distrust of the legal establishment in lots of communities as well, so they wouldn't think it was a good idea to become a magistrate and so on. But it is a real problem that magistrates are skewed, old, and middle class, and the ethnic minority mix is also not where it is, not quite the same as the census. And in some areas, it's particularly bad. But the other thing that I researched in my report is that some communities are completely unrepresented, almost completely unrepresented. So I live in Camden, where the Somali community is a big community. And that it has its challenges in terms of being in trouble with the law, particularly teenage Somali boys. But if you look at the ranks of the magistracy, there really aren't any Somali magistrates.
Yeah.
Equally, there aren't Gypsy and Roma magistrates. There are very few magistrates from Eastern European communities and so on.
Do you feel that the deficiencies you've identified have led to a significant number of miscarriages of justice at the behest of the magistrates' courts?
The problems in the magistrates' courts go further than whether the magistrates are representative of their communities. I think, the fact that they don't get enough training is as important as the fact that they're not representative. And they don't get enough training. They get something like 3 days training a magistrate before they sit. But I'm equally, I have to say, critical of the setup in which you get district judges operating in the magistrates' courts. So you can get a district judge, and they are trained lawyers, but you can get them sitting in a magistrates' court, and they don't have a trained legal advisor to sit with them a lot of the time. And the prosecutor in that court might be somebody who also is not a trained lawyer. And they could be an associate prosecutor, and you could have an unrepresented defendant.
Yeah.
And that district judge can sentence that defendant in that context to a significant length of imprisonment. So I think the whole magistrates' court system can lend itself to miscarriages of justice.
Yeah, but I mean, so we're talking here about the court that deals with 99% of our criminal work, and it sounds from your personal experience and all of the research that you've done that you're not over impressed with the level of justice that the magistrates' court churns out.
I have huge worries about it. Yes, I do.
I absolutely agree with you about that. We're speaking about a topic that doesn't feature in the public eye often enough. The position in relation to Transform Justice is that what the organisation seeks to do is to enhance the system through promoting change. That's the position, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. And in relation to the work of Transform Justice, as I've said, I mean, you've produced many fantastic reports. One that I just want to ask you about briefly is remand overused in England and Wales? Because this is a topic very close to my own heart. I mean, my answer to that question, is remand overused in England and Wales, is a resounding yes. What's your view on the issue?
Another resounding yes. And I've looked at all the data and done research on it. And again, it's particularly an issue in the magistrates' courts, which day to day you probably don't see. But the majority of cases where magistrates remand somebody and then they hear the trial, that person doesn't get a custodial sentence. So what you've got is thousands of people being imprisoned on remand who are then released into the community, either acquitted or they get a community sentence, which indicates to me that the kind of initial decision made could have been different. You know, the risk of that person reoffending or absconding or whatever was not well made.
Could have been different and should have been different.
I agree, should have been different. But this is an incredibly difficult nut to crack because you've got a very ingrained habits of thought with the prosecution, the judiciary, even the defence.
We have a remand population in this country of several thousands. In terms of their incarceration, the regime they are subjected to is not dissimilar to that of convicted prisoners, and in some respects is worse, because I hear over and over again from my clients that it's unfair because they can't take up education and jobs in the same way as convicted prisoners. Is that an aspect you looked at in your report, and what are your feelings about those difficulties?
I mean, to be honest, the prison rules are regularly flouted because remand prisoners are supposed to be kept separately from convicted prisoners. They're supposed to be able to wear their own clothes. They're supposed to have enhanced family visits and so on. And in a lot of prisons, with both under 18s, children and adults, it just doesn't happen. And I think it's one of the reasons why remand is a huge problem. And in fact, I spoke to an academic who'd looked at people who plead guilty when they are in fact innocent. And one of the issues she looked at was if you're on remand for a certain kind of offence, it can be worth your while to plead guilty rather than stick around with a kind of waiting for your trial when you might get a very similar outcome.
Yeah.
So actually, the conditions of remand are really, really difficult. And the evidence is that a greater proportion of those who commit suicide come from the remand population.
Well, I absolutely agree with all the sentiments you've expressed. And again, I'd love to have you come back on a future occasion and focus exclusively on the issue of remand imprisonment, because it's an incredibly important issue.
But can I also say it's very, very current, because I, with other kind of organisations, are trying to encourage the government to get the numbers in prison down at the moment because of COVID-19.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of those populations they could easily get down is the Roman population.
I absolutely agree with you. And certainly, you know, more and more bail applications are being encouraged. The question is whether the judiciary are going to adapt their more traditional mindset and grant bail on a more generous basis. I suspect your feeling about that is that they will not.
Well, I think there's two things. I mean, I think they might, but also the numbers coming through are going to be much lower at the moment because the charging decisions made by the police are definitely different at the moment.
Mm. The reality of the position in the criminal justice world at the moment is that the criminal courts are closed with very few exceptions, certainly at Crown Court level where the more serious crime is being tried. To what extent do you feel that the overriding principle of open justice is being eroded?
I mean, in reality, the courts are open to a select group, but closed to the public. And to me, this is incredibly important. So the government advice says that somebody who just wants to observe a case would not meet their test about essential travel and so on.
Yeah.
So, you know, you couldn't just turn up at a magistrate's court, which, by the way, some are open and they are actually hearing these first appearance cases. You couldn't do it. So, in effect, the court is closed and then they are hearing some cases. So these people who are detained by the police have to be produced in court then the next day that a court is running. So those cases are happening, and some of those are happening on video. And I absolutely know they're happening, and lawyers are going on video from their homes in order to... the prosecution are doing it from home and the defence are doing it from home, for instance, in Kent. So I've spent the last week trying to gain access to those hearings. So these are the hearings where decisions about remand and bail are made. And actually, some people in the magistrates' courts are sentenced on their first appearance. So that's also happening. And I've been trying for a whole week. I've used all my connections. I know that technically I could access those hearings, and I have totally failed so far. And I'm an insider in the sense that I understand the system. I understand the people to go to ask. And I actually know technically that those video hearings are happening. When a normal member of the public would never know that, and even I can't get access. So that says to me, magistrates' courts are closed.
Again, you've raised a whole number of really vital issues. If I could just come back in sort of quasi-general terms on two aspects. Firstly, you've identified the question of hearings taking place at the magistrates' court, which is a court that is sitting and open to the public, but any attendance by a member of the public would be a flagrant breach of social distancing policy. That's point one. And point two is that in relation to important hearings in the Crown Court, for example, bail hearings, which you rightly say are taking place, but to which the public have no access, that is another fundamental inroad to the overriding principle of open justice. Question I want to ask you is, what is to be done about these complications in these exceptional and incredibly challenging times?
They are incredibly challenging, and I take my hat off to people who are keeping the show on the road. But I would say, I would, you know, really plead with lawyers to also challenge that issue about the public access. I think what's happening is they're really worried about giving somebody, you know, public access via these video systems because they're afraid that that person might then record them at home or whatever, which you're not allowed to do. You're not allowed to record cases. But I would say let us in and then prosecute somebody who contravenes the law. So I think that everybody feels that this is just how it is, that these cases are being held in this way, which is closed. And the other thing I just want to point out is some concessions are being made to journalists. But to me, there's a fundamental principle, which is that it's still not an open hearing if the public can't gain access.
Yeah, but so for example, on bail applications, which concern the liberty of the subject, not only that subject, but family members, friends and supporters have no access to the hearing at which the destiny of that individual is decided. I mean, on the face of it, that is, you know, a radical contravention of the principle of open justice. But if it was to be said, well, this is the only way we can do it, bearing in mind resources and technical, you know, potential, do you sympathise with those arguments?
I mean, I sympathise it's really difficult, but I also know that technically, if a journalist can get into a hearing, it would be possible to get a member of the public into that hearing digitally as well, even if it's via a mobile phone. So I'm sympathetic, but I feel there's a real urgency about resolving this problem, because apart from anything we've heard this week about this very worrying case which happened in the magistrates' court, where a woman called Marie Deneux was arrested at Newcastle station on one of these new corona offences, yeah, from the Corona Virus Act. She appears to have been detained in the police station for 2 days for not telling the police why she was at Newcastle station. She also seems to have been not had the right ticket, but normally you would never be detained in police custody for not having the right ticket. So it must have been the Corona Virus Act offence. Then she appeared in a magistrate's court and was fined £660, which in addition to the 2 nights in custody is an awfully harsh sentence for not saying why you're in a place. And then this has had to be undone. But as far as I can work out, the only reason anybody knew about that case was because British Transport Police actually did a press release about it.
Yeah, no, I think you've identified an incredibly important case. And of course, the fact that the police charged her with the wrong offence, and that not only has the conviction been overturned, but she's not now being prosecuted for anything, is a conglomeration of very worrying issues. I mean, I want to move on in just a moment as we approach a conclusion to the question of jury trials. But on the question of the creation of offences vis-a-vis, you know, coronavirus and the police having powers to stop people from travelling, send them home, demand details of people's journeys and intended whereabouts. I mean, what's your view on that?
You know, I mean, I think the police have just got to use their discretion. I mean, there's some great police out there and they need to use their discretion as best they can, which they clearly didn't in this case. So I think that, you know, in the main, they need to go back to the Pelian principle, yeah, of policing by consent, yeah, and trying to engage with people. And let's hope that not too many people are prosecuted.
Yeah, absolutely. In relation to the question of jury trials, the position is that ongoing trials were aborted, imminent trials have been adjourned, long-term fixed trials have been really kicked into the distance. We have on the horizon an unbelievable concoction of problems relating to jury trials. If it was to be suggested that in the meantime, jury trials should be conducted on video, but with access to the public, to what extent, if at all, would you be opposed to that?
I just don't think we can do it so suddenly, because anything like that needs to be properly set up, piloted, evaluated and so on. And we're talking about, you know, justice is such a nuanced thing, and the Crown Court trial is a very complex process. So I think, I mean, what I'm, again, going back to Roman, what I'm really worried about with the, you know, no jury trials is that there are some people who've been in prison already on remand a very long time, and that what we call custody time limit is being exceeded. So I'm really worried about that, and I'm worried that some of those people will plead guilty because of the stress involved in the time they're waiting. But I just think we've got to hold fire on the jury trials.
And if it was to be suggested, which has certainly been mooted in discussion, but not to my knowledge in a more official context, that we should bring in emergency legislation to substitute judge-only trials for jury trials, do I suspect that you would be vociferously against that?
Totally and absolutely, yes. I mean, going back to the jury trials, I do think something needs to be done. We need to know these defendants who are on the longest remand periods, we need to know how long they've been in and what these new custody time limits are for them. And there is no information in the public domain about that. And somehow we need to take those ones who are in for the longest periods and see if we could do it in a venue where the jury could be socially distanced or something.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, the question of jury trials throws up so many issues for later discussion. Can I move finally to the question of prisons? In terms of the work that your charity does, Transform Justice, have you collated data, or are you in a position to express your views about the quality of prison officers in this country?
Oh, it's not my expertise, but I would say that, you know, like with any workforce, like with the police, there are some brilliant ones, there are some less brilliant ones. But the problem you've got with prison officers is that when Chris Grayling reduced their numbers massively, the most experienced ones left. So the ones that we have at the moment, the average number of years of experience is very, very little. And it's a very difficult thing to be a prison officer. So we've got a huge turnover of people coming in and going out. And what we desperately need is a reduction in the population in prison, the number of prisoners we've got, so that prison officers can work towards having a more fulfilling role.
And on that aspect, what would you say to the many members of the public who are worried and against the early release of prisoners?
I mean, I absolutely understand their worry, and I have done research about it. I think, you know, what we need to do is a whole system approach, actually, and we need to prevent people going into prison who are there for some of the non-violent offences or have mental health problems or fewer on remand. And then we could reduce the numbers that way. And then we need to look at the sentences we give. So our sentences in this country, prison sentences, have got longer and longer and longer for the same crime over the last 10 years.
And in that background, I mean, you've touched on sentencing there and the sort of general state of our prisons. As regards Transform Justice and the objective of enhancing the system through promoting change, if you were able to identify any outstanding aspect of the system Transform Justice wanted to see changed, what would it be?
I mean, you know, in an ideal world, I would like a different public debate about what is achieved, you know, how to reduce crime and whether harsh punishment achieves that.
Can I just ask you finally, we have a criminal justice system in this country, which, you know, usually speaking, not at the moment, but usually speaking, functions up and down the United Kingdom day in, day out. What would you say about the quality of our criminal justice system? How do you rate it?
I think that there are huge problems with the kind of criminal sanctions we mete out, in that they don't, I don't feel, and many others don't, that they're actually effective in terms of turning people's lives around and away from crime. And equally, I have concerns about the quality of justice and whether it is actually fair, particularly in the magistrates' court some of the time.
And now that coronavirus has intervened, are you worried that scope for development, progress, improvement has been radically undermined?
I don't know. I mean, I think time will tell what the actual changes are. I mean, this is getting us into a huge new subject. Very worried about the way that the people who are enthusiastic about digital justice have moved so swiftly to put important cases on video or even just telephone conference call.
Yeah, you mean without ostensible regard for the principle of open justice. I mean, do you think there is a possibility that coronavirus will bring attention to the penal system in a way that's been needed for a while?
It's getting very little airtime on the national news at the moment, so I'm not sure about that. And, I would hope so. I'm afraid that the health aspects have overtaken everything else in terms of media attention.
Yeah. All right. Well, Penelope, can I say, first of all, that, you've discussed a large number of incredibly important issues and, given us the clearest possible perspective, but really look forward to speaking to you again. And I'd just like to express my gratitude to you for giving up your time to contribute to this podcast.
Well, it's been great, and it's good to meet you even digitally, and we must meet in person.
Definitely.
when we can.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Okay, great.
Thank you for listening. Join me again next time for another episode of Criminal Justice on Trial. Please don't forget to subscribe. And if you like what you heard, give us a good review. And if you have a story to tell, get in touch. Tweet us at justice_ontrial.